started again here.
So I'm Bill Inchcliff, and if you're here, you know there's such thing as a radical archaeologist conference. So pretty excited. All right, so my talk is Society Against the Chiefdom, and I'm writing up this analysis of warfare and defensive sites. Kind of going to provide an overview of my dissertation research. In 1790, the Spanish Quimper expedition entered the Gulf of Georgia in the northwest coast and became the first to document the lives of Coast Salish peoples. They found them to be distinctive from the people on the west coast of Vancouver Island in New Chalmun, because over there they'd seen some very powerful chiefs like McKenna, control over large territories, control over numerous villages and households. But in contrast, when they came into the Gulf of Georgia, they remarked that the Coast Salish recognized no superior chief. And instead of one powerful chief, they encountered several. And the area has been also unique to anthropologists as exceptions, because here you have societies where there are chiefs without chiefdoms, class stratification without state centralization, large residential villages for people that were hunter-gatherers. The Coast Salish and Northwest Coast cultures have been exceptions to many classic anthropological models of socio-political evolution. These schemes typically are constructed as trajectories, often teleological ones, that lead to states, that is, they're based on increasing centralization. But the pattern for the Northwest Coast, and particularly the Coast Salish, is one that defies centralization. And Wayne Suttles described their political organization as not that of a pyramid. On the other hand, their society was not egalitarian in any manner. There were classes from elites to slaves. Instead, Suttles famously described their social organization as the inverted pair, where there are more elites than commoners and slaves. So since the Coast Salish are not centralized, or not egalitarian, I prefer to regard them as an anarchic society. And so to evaluate their sociopolitics, I'm going to use the framework based on anarchism as it can encompass this complexity. And again, I apply it. The Spanish, by the way, also found the Coast Salish to be quite warlike, and here in advance that warfare is in part related to how they recognize no superior chief. Now, the concept of anarchy has been used by political scientists for analyzing warfare. But they use it in the sense of chaos, that when warfare is present, there is no overarching authority governing the groups involved. But by using anarchy in this manner, they imply a situation where there are not only a lack of control, but they're also implying the autonomy of the groups involved in the conflict. And actually, through conflict itself, they resolve who are the relationships of authority. But of course, as you know, rather than chaos, anarchism is a theory about a form of social order. So the basic premise here is that the theory of anarchism is useful for understanding societies without formal governments. Anarchism is a theory for organizing society without the centralization of leadership, and it exhibits a keen assessment of the nature of social power. It also has advantages for archaeologists with its basis in materialism and practicality, and its locus of action in individuals that cooperate in endeavors with others in network forms of organization. Anarchists have long debated how to implement their core principles for the organization of society in movements and collectives. And these principles include local and individual autonomy and expression, voluntary association, mutual aid, network organization, decentralization, and active resistance to centralization, and justified forms of authority and resistance to authoritarianism. And thanks to the papers this morning, I don't think I really need to go through these principles in any detail. I just that they all interlink in themselves. People are autonomous, but they do relate and into cooperative forms, into mutual aid, and these are done through voluntary association and the justified nature of authority. And so I'll just focus on the last part here and on a quote by Bakunin. So while building connections, while building connections, mutual aid, and alliances are something anarchists support, concentrated authority is something they detest. Saul Newman has remarked that history for anarchists is a struggle between humanity and power, and this link is clear in anarchist theory, and its resistance is directed foremost at the state. However, as archaeologists, we're concerned with the application of power within all types of societies, especially non-state societies, but the connection is nonetheless clear. Accordingly, authoritarian power in all contexts is something that should be met with resistance. So while they oppose authoritarian power, they do not oppose authority in itself. Bakunin states, "I bow before the authority of special men because it is imposed upon me by my own reason. Therefore, there is no fixed and constant authority, but a continual exchange of mutual, temporary, and above all, voluntary authority and association." And I like this quote because it's talking really about the temporary nature and the constant renegotiation of the relationships of these principles and how people relate in larger networks. So the allotment of authority must be situationally justified, and this notion of justification also applies to the other principles that I've listed, and as with alliances, which is what I'll focus on here. As the need for alliance, once it is fulfilled, that union might dissipate back, returning autonomy to local groups. So with that as a theoretical framework, I'd like to turn now to the case study in the Coast Salish area, looking at defensive sites and how they've organized them, and I find the expressions of these principles. So in spatial scale, the Coast Salish implemented a large array of defensive sites, each of which indicate a certain range of organization. The smallest and most primary form is the underground refuge, documented ethnographically by Homer Barnett. These are hidden openings into a underground house, as they called it, but they opened up and they were used during periods of attack, especially to hide women and children. In investigations I conducted at Smelt Bay in the northern Gulf of Georgia, we encountered two of these underground refuges. Now these are the normally coastal villages the houses are built above ground, and then the Middenburgs form the outlines of them that are visible today. So these are very unusual to subterranean depressions. Notably, these are located adjacent to existing plank houses with entrances likely hidden in the wooden platforms that would have been around the perimeter of the house. But the point really that I want to make here is that this is a form of defense that's organized and controlled by the household. That's the most concern. These structures serve the needs of that household that owned them, and they controlled access to them. And this appears consistent with Suttle's emphasis for the Coast Salish, for the household is the primary organizational unit. Of course, he was talking about production. Here it's expressed in terms of the organization of defense. But one thing is really apparent. This is not even a depiction of surface map of the whole village, but those are the only two underground houses. Not every house has one of these. And so to think in terms of defense, what's going on here, we have to consider the actual regional context of Smelt Bay. So let's do that. And in the Smelt Bay area, there's a whole range of defensive sites. And the one I'm going to focus on now are called trench embankment sites. And I'll just show a few examples of these. This is one that's on a rocky headland type setting. That area is about 40 by 40 meters, and there's a trench just across the middle of the headland to help protect the interior there. And this is just a photograph of how deep these trenches can be. This is a bluff type setting for these forts. So while the bluff protects on one edge, you've got a huge trench around the back. And here's a view of how deep and high these trenches can be. And imagine if you're scaling these and reach the top, that's when you reach up to a 15, 20 meter high palisade sometimes. Very high palisade. Next example, and this one is just a couple of kilometers north of Smelt Bay, the last site I just showed you. So they've got a trench partially obscured right at the neck, but the real area that's defended is in the back. And actually, that's quite a small area, 30 by 30 meters of protection on the high sand spit. So these areas are quite small. And so that's kind of interesting. So Smelt Bay is rimmed by a lot of these sites, but the actual, when you look at the area of the Smelt Bay sites, it's quite massive. But the size of these trench embankments are really quite small. And in fact, not one of any of those fortifications can be intended really for the village as a whole, which kind of makes sense. In the Coast Salish, you don't have activities that are done by the village as a whole. And in fact, the village, these are hunter-gatherers, it's a temporary amalgamation of people in any way. So I interpret these as being associated with clusters of households from these villages. And if you look and consider it that way, you've got Smelt Bay, and it's rimmed by a perimeter by several of these very small trench embankments. But and so if a large-scale attack did occur, you would also see a dispersed to various respective defensive sites. Now, that's an interpretation, but ethnographically, that matches the way they've handled defense. They did handle defense in a distributed manner. It minimizes the threat to each particular household, but also it enables the possibility for cooperation on a larger scale. And so this can be viewed as a network of interaction. And for here, I use the model of David Sheppey, who'd done for the Coast Salish Stalo area, where he advocated a similar network applied to a canyon-type setting. And here, we have the same kind of thing, lines of sight between a whole series of sites. So we have lookouts that are on the outer rims. And other sites are hidden and accessible, including underground housing. Now, this notion of lookouts and messengers and fire signal stations is also consistent with the very distributed and multiple vantage point defense described for the Coast Salish. But the main point here is this is a scale of organization that's beyond the scale of the village. Furthermore, multiple scales of defense would be appropriate for the type of conflicts that the Coast Salish households face. Oral and written histories are very clear that conflict is mostly within and between Coast Salish groups. So in actuality, even if you're at the village at Smelt Bay, most conflicts would be directed at a particular household. You have stories explicitly saying that even warning, get away from that house. That's where the attack is going to be directed. And you know that those attacks might occur resulting from a murder or even a perceived insult at a potlatch. But those, according to a lot of ethno-historic accounts, easily inflate and begin to involve allied households, attacking allied households. And then even these can intensify to involve regional groups, say the Cowichan versus the Klallam, which would require even larger scale coordination to protect against. But the point is that these defenses, based on their scale, can be flexibly appropriate, but yet still allow some kind of autonomy to this group. Now, there is even evidence for an even larger scale organization among the Coast Salish, but for this example, I want to turn to oral accounts about the battle at Maple Bay. This event occurred likely in the late 1830s. These chiefs, the Coast Salish chiefs, called for a council of war, inviting chiefs throughout Coast Salish territory to participate and hear the arguments for a large-scale attack upon Willetwaltok, or Southern Pequawkla. This group, ever since the fur trade began, fur traders would go up the outer coast, and so they had readier access to firearms. And they were using it to expand into Coast Salish territory. They overtook much of Comox territory. And not only that, but they'd raid all the way up the Fraser River, deep into Puget Sound, constant raidings with the advantage in firearms. And they called this council war to try to put an end to these decades. So they requested that the number of groups that involved is pretty astounding. It ranges from the deep in Puget Sound up in the Fraser River. It draws from groups throughout most of the Coast Salish area. And so at Maple Bay, the Coast Salish Alliance and Traffic Local will talk to news within the bay, coordinating off all exits. And depending on all the accounts, they completely defeated the local talk, leaving a few survivors. But the battle served to end this cycle of raiding and the southern expansion of the local talk. But one intriguing detail from these accounts of Maple Bay is that the decision mainly to call the Council of War was held by the Cowichan. And the story about the weeks before that, they'd been actually raiding in Puget Sound. And when they returned back from the raids, their own village had been sacked by the Wiltok, their houses burned to the ground, the remaining men all killed, women and children all taken as slaves, and the accounts say not a dog remained, it was said. And they then called upon these other groups. But some of the groups that they called upon were groups in Puget Sound, where they had just been raiding. And in fact, many of these, Clallam versus Cowichan and so on, are longtime enemies, but they participate together in this attack. So the oral history of this battle indicates and illustrates a core principle of their social organization, which is that Coast Salish groups largely act autonomously, but they organize together into larger network forms to meet certain needs. And in the absence of these needs, the broad alliance disbands and local autonomy prevails again. And in fact, when you look at all these accounts, they even seem to compete as to who was the real warriors in those battles that really participated. The point of these is scales is that it increases from the base in the household and incrementally increases in scale to include larger alliances with other households in the village, regional networks, and to call on distant, if you know, allies. Each scale of social organization also has a corresponding material manifestation in an archaeologically visible defensive feature. From the underground house to allied households with fortifications through broad-scale coalitions. Differing scales of alliance for the organization of defense meet Proudhon's notion of societies as dense with tensions. Factions will continually try to consolidate power, and other factions will try to oppose such efforts. And so I've addressed this here for the late period in terms of spatial assessment, but it's also good to look at the case temporally. And so for the last couple of millennia, I just want to look at of Coast Salish past. There were periods when elites consolidated power, marked by expressions of increasing social differentiation or inequality. And I want to compare that to periods of warfare. And so with salmon production and storage beginning to intensify about 3,500 BP, that's when they first make arguments that social ranking appears out of egalitarian foraging groups. Archaeologists have argued that social stratification, though, occurred only later with Marpole, 2000. Typical accounts usually present that when stratification starts, it just goes all the way through contact. But actually, it's not so simple. But one feature that I want to look at to track here is cranial deformation practiced by the Coast Salish, in which an infant's skull is shaped as a marker of group identity. Several archaeologists have argued that since these markers are applied to infants, the introduction of cranial deformation marks the beginning of hereditary class stratification. So they're not earning their status, they're born into it. A colleague and I examined burial data for the evidence of cranial deformation throughout these times, the last 2,000 years. And during the Marpole period, cranial deformation was indeed practiced by only a minority. But with the onset of warfare, beginning with the late Mark Old into the late period, Coast Salish people bear the stray of cranial deformation than do not. The other interesting aspect is that it's still regarded as an elite marker. So it's not a battleship curve where something is initially a high status item but then becomes commonplace and loses that high status. This still retains its association with eliteness according to most ethnographers. So in an essence, this tracks the development in a way of Suttle's inverted pair society. Radiocarbon dates, however, from the late period defensive sites end about 500 BP. So that period ends. And with the onset of peace, we also have a period with the, again, the entrenchment of elite power. And here I'm going to point to David Sheppey's work, who argues for the rise of chiefs beginning about 550. And the trait that he looks at is the differences in household pit house size. He found them to be quite increasing in scale, about 550 BP, and associated that with increasing social differentiation. And these inequities increase until contact with the onset of the fur trade. Another period of warfare ensues and lasts for a century. But subsequently, historians noted the rise at this time of a nouveau riche, and the term itself indicating that eliteness broadened for the population just as before. And in fact, it's only really decades later when the anthropologists there would describe the Coast Salish pattern as the inverted pair society. So taking an anarchist perspective here, warfare can be seen as a factor contributing to decentralization, an attack on the hegemony of elites. If the power of elite classes were more entrenched during these periods, then I argue that warfare served to fragment their hold on elite exchange networks, allowing others to participate in this. But notably, this is not class conflict precisely. They're not acting as a class trying to overthrow the elite. Instead, they are factions of households and individuals aiming to become elite themselves and bear these traits. And ultimately broadens and democratizes elite inclusion. Now, Pierre Clausius in Society Against the State made a similar point, arguing that warfare for South American groups was an act that negated concentrations of power. Warfare does not occur because of fragmentation, rather it instigates fragmentation. For Clausius, warfare in small-scale societies serves to maintain each community in its political independence. Warfare in such settings has a centrifugal logic that works against the centripetal logic of the state or against any hegemonic entity trying to concentrate, consolidate, or institutionalize power. Now, applying Clausius to the Coast Salish context, if one chief is seen to gain too much power, it only requires the alliance of two or three other chiefs to ally and remove that chief from power, sacking their wealth and status. Moreover, this notion of resistance to the centralization of power and unjustified authorities is explicit, really, and common in Coast Salish oral narratives, where highly regarded warriors, powerful religious leaders, and even mythical transformative figures are called upon on their claims of power and put to death, or with the latter frozen in stone and serving as lasting reminders on the landscape of to not misuse power. So, here I found that a theoretical framework based in anarchism can readily incorporate the tensions in Coast Salish sociopolitical organization. It encompasses the dynamics of the opposed forces of autonomy versus cooperation. For anarchists, the principles of voluntary association and the justification of those relationships provide mediation between these polar tensions. Often archaeologists can seem to mourn the decline of climax periods, or cultural peaks, in the archaeological record. And Marpole here would be that kind of climax period regarded in the Coast Salish area. However, viewed through the lens of anarchism, these periods are peaks for social inequality as well. And the immediate periods that follow are often seen by archaeologists as cultural declines or collapses with attendant connotations of chaos, even anarchy. But in an anarchist framework, these so-called collapses often represent a sense for autonomy of individuals and the return of power to the control of local groups. And in the Coast Salish case, the expansion of eliteness to a broad majority in inverted pair society. So in conclusion, tendencies have appeared for the consolidation of power in the Coast Salish past, but the longer trend is one of society against the chiefdom. Now, an anarchist framework, I thought, worked well for the unique Coast Salish situation, but these principles certainly should find expression in egalitarian and even in centralized societies as befitting their own local settings and circumstances. Groups continually renegotiate these social-political relationships, and these principles are continually expressed or suppressed for any society. And so the patterns for these shifts should be apparent in the archaeological record. Thank you.